Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. This hour, we are talking about how this new coronavirus behaves, what lessons we can learn from similar outbreaks in the past, and what lies ahead for the spread of the virus. Joining me now, Dr. Edison Liu, who is president and CEO of the Jackson Laboratories. He's a physician and cancer researcher who previously led the scientific response for the country of Singapore for the SARS crisis in 2003. He has also held leading roles at the Human Genome Organization and the National Cancer Institute. Dr. Liu, thanks so much for joining us on Maine Calling.
My pleasure, Jennifer.
As always, we want to hear from you and the audience. What questions do you have about how COVID-19 is spread and what the future may hold for this pandemic? Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Liu, it's so easy to be swept up in some of the, I think paranoia and hysteria on social media, yet this is a very, very scary disease. And I just am so grateful that you're here to help offer some perspective. I understand you already have experience dealing with a coronavirus outbreak in the past. Tell us about that, the SARS crisis in Singapore.
Well, in 2003, I don't think the world was prepared for anything like this. It was a completely new virus. We didn't even know what it was. And it was quickly spreading with a significant mortality. And so I was the senior scientist for the whole genome effort in Singapore at that time. And the solution to it, which was what the first solution to it, which is what would happen in the first weeks of the outbreak this time around for COVID-19, was to sequence the virus. In other words, to get its genetic imprint so you know exactly what virus it is and how it differs from previous viruses. To our surprise at that time, it was a coronavirus. We quickly made a diagnostic for it, which is based on this technique called polymerase chain reaction, PCR. And that was the beginning of the control efforts, the ability to discern individuals who had the SARS versus those who had the flu, separate them out so that the healthcare workers can take special precautions and then provide more intensive care for those individuals. It was really the containment effort that eliminated the SARS, because by the time the SARS was eliminated through these efforts of testing, tracking, and treating, that we were able to control it on a population level. I think the same sequence of actions are being done right now with COVID-19, but at a grander scale than what we had with SARS.
What are the characteristics of COVID-19 that make it so particularly concerning?
Well, for both SARS and COVID-19, they're virulent viruses. People do die. And now, there's been somewhat debates about how serious it is. I would argue that if you're one who was severely affected by it, there's no debate. You're no longer a statistic. SARS was in 2003 more virulent than COVID-19. But let me give you a little perspective. COVID-19 is 10 times more virulent than the common flu that we see today. And the flu kills tens of thousands of people every year. You can imagine 10 times more of that is really quite significant. The difference between SARS and COVID-19 is COVID-19 is much more infectious than SARS itself. And that by itself has been a major problem for everybody trying to control it. And again, by comparison, it is even more infectious than the current flu that we have. So you have something that's more infectious than flu and more virulent, causing more deaths and hospitalizations. and you've got a very bad combination.
Well, let's talk about that concept of being more infectious than the flu. Can you talk specifically about how the virus spreads, where it lives, how long it survives in the air or on surfaces?
Yes. COVID-19, like most coronaviruses, are actually spread through air droplets from coughing and from sneezing. And these are purely experimental systems that were recently tested and published. But COVID-19 can exist in aerosols. There are these little droplets in the air up to 3 hours. The distance in terms of a cough or a sneeze is usually up to 6 feet. It most frequently is less, but that's why you have this 6 feet distancing guideline that is given. When it's on surfaces, it varies. And again, these are experimental conditions and not necessarily ones that have been tested in the field. But it's around 3 days with a shorter time period with cardboard and a longer time period in stainless steel and plastic. So it varies, and it varies in terms of humidity and temperature, though it's not so clear as to how the temperature and humidity truly affects the virus in the wild. So it's mainly contact. That includes, by the way, your hands. That's why they are suggesting don't shake hands. Certainly by respiratory tract. So it's coughing, kissing, those actions.
So you're talking about coughing and kissing. Let's say so many people are wondering about just the simple daily going on a walk or something like that. If one walks by somebody else and they're 6 feet away and the person isn't coughing, can you catch coronavirus?
Well, you know, there are individuals that have been identified who are asymptomatic but who carry the virus. Usually, not always, these individuals, if they exist in the community, express much less of the virus than the sick ones. It only makes sense. So especially if you're outside, the air droplets, the experiments that were done that said they're about 3 hours, is done in enclosed settings, you know, so they linger. If it's outside, it's highly unlikely that these droplets will linger and be, you know, more or less blown away. So I would say, to be honest with you, I try to walk my talk, and I go for walks. Of course, I keep a respectful distance, but I do need some exercise.
So you wouldn't discourage people from going outside. Just stay away from them, other people, by 6 feet.
Well, let's put it this way. It's all a matter of relative timing and what have you. If you're going to spend 12 hours outside, the probability of you getting in close contact with somebody in a city is extraordinarily high. If you're going to take a half hour walk in a public park, like we have here in Bar Harbor, Acadia, it's highly unlikely that you're going to catch the virus.
How are these numbers determined? For example, no gathering with groups of less than or more than 10 people. How do we come up with these kind of numbers, 6 feet, 10 feet people?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. And sometimes people, rightfully so, feel that they're kind of drawn out of a hat. These are still all estimates, but they are based on some mathematical principles. When we said about 6 feet, there have been engineers that have, using very sensitive techniques, have tracked how far aerosols travel after a cough. And that six feet is sort of a culmination of a bunch of studies, and it's only an estimate, but it's a rational estimate. In terms of the number of 10, it goes something like this. And by the way, it gets complicated. If you assume a certain number of people in the United States randomly distributed with COVID-19, okay, and if you just randomly picked Americans out of a hat and said, what is the probability of Jennifer Rook picking out a person with COVID-19 infection, that would be that number. It would be 200,000 over 340 million Americans. So you can see the odds are very low that if you pick one person out of the population, that you would get a person who's infected with COVID-19. But let's just say you have a gathering. You know, one of them was the March Madness that they had to cancel. Estimated to be 75,000 individuals coming from all over the United States in enclosed space. Okay, and in that context, if you do the statistics, the probability of having one person with COVID-19 in that space is over 90%. Now, the challenge is that the one person in that space, on the average, can actually pass on in an encounter with to 2.6 individuals. If that person's staying for the whole tournament, you can imagine the number. And each person who's infected would subsequently infect others. So you can see how a number these congregations would actually be very dangerous. The number 10 is an estimate, but the probability that you randomly would pick somebody, 10 people, with one having a COVID-19 infection is less than 1%. So that's kind of how it's estimated. It is complicated, but the numbers are not are dreamt up.
We're speaking with Dr. Edison Liu, who is president and CEO of the Jackson Lab in Bar Harbor. Dr. Liu, I wanted to ask you what the Jackson Lab is doing when it comes to coronavirus and similar infectious diseases.
Yeah, it's several things, but one of the most important is that in a new pandemic or epidemic that we have, that is a major public health crisis, we need model systems to be able to test the not only the biology of the COVID-19, but also how you treat it. The idea that you can pull some drugs out of a pharmacy and just apply it to people who are sick just doesn't work. We've done that 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and there were so many errors in doing it that way that we started to do what we would call clinical trials. But, you know, clinical trials takes time, and therefore having animal models that we can test whether a drug works or not becomes absolutely vital in getting a solution to the COVID-19. In 2007, Dr. Perlman at the University of Iowa actually constructed a mouse that would be a model for SARS infection. Now, why this is important is that you can't take any old mouse and try to infect it with COVID-19, because the receptor that actually binds to the virus and brings the virus into cells so it can infect a cell is called the ACE2 protein. It only binds COVID-19 and SARS only binds to the human form and not the mouse form. And therefore, scientists have actually engineered the mouse with the human ACE2 protein so that it becomes a decent model for that disease. Well, that model has been dormant for many years, and so what Jackson Labs does is that we are the major center for human genetics and mouse genetics, complex genetics, And we're one of the few places in the world that can actually, in a facile manner, very quickly expand populations of this very special mice and to ship it to the investigators who are actually trying to find solutions to the COVID-19 problem.
Interesting. I want to ask you about people who have tested positive for COVID-19 and then recovered. Do these people have immunity now from catching it again? And if so, could they be put to good use, for example, in a healthcare setting?
Absolutely. Actually, it's expected, still needs to be absolutely determined, but it's highly likely, very, very highly likely, that an individual who's survived COVID-19 will have immunity against it. And these antibodies are actually protective. So there are efforts now ongoing to recruit some of these individuals to be able to take their serum, isolate the antibodies in their serum, and to use it as a therapeutic for COVID-19 patients who are with active infection and who are in extreme condition. This has been done before in the past. Before we had antibiotics, this was these anti-sera were used for pneumococcal pneumonia, for example, in the 1920s. But once antibiotics came around, they fell into disuse because it couldn't be scaled. But for something like the COVID-19, where we don't have therapies just yet, this is a viable form of treatment, even though it doesn't scale very well. You have to isolate it from an individual, you have to purify it, and then you have to give it what kind of dose, how many doses are from a single individual, we still don't know.
You know, we've been told over and over again that many of us who may have COVID-19, many people who either don't have symptoms or have symptoms but don't kind of qualify to get tested right now with the limits on testing, may develop COVID-19, may recover from it, but never are tested for it. Could those people at some point be tested to see if they have the antibody in their system?
Absolutely, and that's many, many groups are trying to develop a specific antibody test that can be used in populations. This becomes very important for planners because it gives us an estimate of where the virus had been and also whether or not this concept of herd immunity is being achieved. Let me just say it's not likely given the numbers that it's required for what we call herd immunity, but those are important calculations.
And you say not likely considering what needs to happen for herd immunity. Does that mean that all of us who are staying at home right now, you know, weeks or months from now when life goes back to normal, that we could see another resurgence because all sorts of people haven't been exposed to it yet?
That's totally true, but that's why we have vaccines. That's why vaccines are so, so important, is that vaccines actually provide herd immunity. Let's define herd immunity because that gets bantered about quite a bit. The whole thing about social isolation is to prevent the virus from infecting the next person. The fewer that virus infects, the less likely it will propagate. If a virus occurs and if you squash its infectivity, you can actually eliminate the disease from a population. And by the way, that's exactly what happened to smallpox when, because of mass vaccination throughout the world, a disease that was a pandemic became non-existent. This is why vaccines are so important. In this context, in order for herd immunity to occur, about 80% of the population plus, more than 80% of the population need to have protective antibodies against a disease before you can actually theoretically squash the spread of an epidemic. And that's a lot. And it's not likely that it's going to happen with COVID-19. And let me just say, the concept of let's just let our population get sick and so we can achieve herd immunity, to me, I have to admit, is inhumane. If you believe that the mortality rate is anywhere between 1% and 4% of people with COVID-19 deaths, if you said 300 million Americans would have to get COVID-19, you're talking about over 3 million Americans dying before herd immunity can be achieved. That is not feasible, nor is it rational. On top of that, it's not everybody that is going to have the greatest mortality. One of the things about COVID-19, very different from the 1918 flu, the Spanish flu, is that the Spanish flu affected every age group. COVID-19 tends to affect the elderly. And when I mean elderly, people primarily over 70 years of age. Over 80 years of age, 1 in 7 individuals will die. Over 70 years of age, about 1 in 10 or 1 in 12 will die. That is, to be frank with you, for somebody who is fast approaching one of those age groups, I think that that would be pretty dim view of achieving herd immunity.
We're talking with Dr. Edison Liu, the CEO of the Jackson Laboratory. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Fresh Eggs Daily, a Maine business committed to helping others raise backyard chickens from hatching chicks to laying hens. FreshEggsDaily.com and Harvard Pilgrim, providing health plans that guide you on your personal path to well-being. Get going at HarvardPilgrim.org.
Many colleges have canceled or postponed graduation ceremonies because of the coronavirus. It's a big blow, especially for students who are the first in their family to get their degree.
I have been waiting for this day since I was little, right? To walk on the stage and have my family there to watch me and everything.
That and the latest coronavirus news this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. There's a wonderful world of learning alive and well, great for making good use of time at home for students of all ages at mainepublic.org. It's called PBS Learning Media, and the offerings are diverse and interesting. For example, learn about the Channel Tunnel, the underwater tunnel that links England and France. It's a story of both perseverance and ingenuity by the tunnel engineers. PBS Learning Media is free, on-demand, online media service for grades K through 12 and curious adults. For more information, go to mainepublic.org. Click on the education drop-down.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, understanding the spread of COVID-19 and how a pandemic unfolds. My guest, Dr. Ed Liu, who is president and CEO of the Jackson Laboratory in Bar Harbor. His background includes helping to stop the SARS outbreak in Singapore. Join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And Dr. Liu, I understand tonight at 7 you're going to be doing an online program with the Ellsworth Library where people can ask you questions. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Okay. I'm looking forward to it.
So people need to just check out the Jackson Lab website to find out how to link up to that, correct?
Yes.
Terrific. Before the break, we were talking about the importance of vaccines. And before I go to the listener questions, I just want to ask, I read that we may be, I don't know if close or far away is the right way to characterize, but maybe early 2021 before there's any kind of vaccine for this coronavirus. Do you agree with that assessment? And if that's the case, does that mean we're not in the clear until 2021?
Those are two different questions, actually. The answer is it will take approximately 12 months before a vaccine can actually be safely registered. When I mean safely, it's not true that all vaccines are safe, and so that has to be tested. There are even vaccines that make the infection worse. Okay, we know that there's a lot of immunology behind that, but that's why these vaccines need to be tested in an orderly fashion, because you're giving it to unaffected individuals in the millions. Okay, so that's really an issue. What will come, and it's coming already, are the antivirals. I've been very heartened by the studies, both positive and negative, Jennifer. That shows some drugs that work and which drugs that don't. And that latter part may sound a little bizarre, but in fact, during the SARS crisis, I saw doctors out of desperation give their patients all sorts of drugs that made sense for non-coronavirus. But in retrospect, after everything cleared, we figured that actually it made things worse. Okay, and this is why a systematic approach is really very important. But these systems are already in place, and I'm very confident that we'll see the first. Well, we're already seeing FDA approving some of the drugs in an early phase, but my hope is we'll see many more coming through.
I'll start with an email from Connie.
Go ahead. Have just one last thing.
Sure.
Address, and that is, you say, do we expect that we can't do anything to 2021? And the answer is no. The effects of the social distancing, we're already seeing the effects on the data. Don't have to go through the details of why, but we are seeing the effects. The second thing is that as our test gets better and better and we get more and more COVID-19 tests, we'll be able to identify people who are at risk for spreading the COVID-19 much better than what we do now, which is really a blunt instrument of sequestering everybody. Once we do that, only those people who have COVID-19 need to be quarantined, and the rest of the world can go on with economy and their life. This is kind of how we do in many other situations. It's just that we don't have enough tests for COVID-19 at this cross section of time.
And do you think soon we'll have a test to be able to determine if people have the antibodies?
Yes, I'm confident we will. It's just a matter of development. The PCR test to see if you're excreting the virus is a very straightforward test. Of course, it requires a lot to qualify it and to make sure that it's valid. But the test itself is not that hard to make. The antibody test needs a little more finesse, you know, and but nevertheless, all those tests will be made. I'm fully confident.
I have an email from Connie. Do we know whether intensity of exposure to the virus causes an increase in symptoms in otherwise healthy people? For example, healthy care providers who become very ill because of their close and frequent exposure versus a healthy person who has casual contact with an infected person.
That's a superb question, Connie. And that's the supposition, because of what we have observed, or the medical community have observed, that the severity amongst healthcare workers seem to be higher than individuals who are the same age group who get exposed in the community. But it's never been experimentally tested, so it's a supposition. It kind of only makes sense. And in fact, this construct that dose makes a difference may have importance in terms of how we quarantine individuals. So the idea that you quarantine everybody who, let's just say, not necessarily at home, but let's say you quarantine them all in one large area, the very ill and the less ill. If that hypothesis is true, we shouldn't be doing that, right? Because you're just making things worse for those who are less ill. So in actual fact, in many countries who have had to begin to tier the isolation, simply because the hospitals are just not able to handle the volume, they're tiering them according to the severity of the symptoms.
We'll go to Mark, who's calling from Vienna. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm grateful that you and Maine Public are doubling your workload in public or program time during this crisis. And thank you to Dr. Liu for joining. I have a question about sheltering at home. Thanks to our local health officer, I've seen a graph of need for hospitalization versus how many ICU beds are available. With no prevention, the need spikes high and fast, way above our capacity. With physical distancing, the need flattens, but still greatly exceeds main intensive care unit beds available. But with shelter at home, the need stayed within the number of hospital beds available. I haven't been able to find the source of the graph, but I wonder if Dr. Liu could comment in general on the value of shelter at home as much as possible. Might that be a main solution or problem for us?
Sure, Mark. And I think what you're referring to, we also have an email from Sari. I think this is the University of Washington projections for Maine that were in the national news over the last couple of days. Dr. Liu.
Yes. I know those projections. I know that institute, and I know the director. They are superb individuals. And by the way, what they are projecting is quantitative, more precise than I believe others, but qualitatively, in terms of what you just said, which is called flattening the curve, everybody has known for probably almost 100 years since the 1918 epidemic. What it is that by flattening the curve, meaning you don't get this huge spike in cases, but you let the cases kind of dribble on. Even though perhaps the numbers are not any different, the stress on the healthcare system is dramatically different. And let me just say, for an infectious disease like this, it is huge. And it's huge because if you can imagine that every bed in your hospital has to be devoted to COVID-19 cases, what if you have a heart attack? What if you have a stroke? What if you break a leg? What if you have appendicitis? You're really in trouble. The second thing is that it isn't just filling the beds, but that that the healthcare workers get infected and they get taken out of their jobs. And in that context, you're losing capacity to take care of people at the same time as swamping the system. It's a double whammy that nobody ever wants to be in. The social isolation or the social distancing policies that have been imposed is, I believe, the only way, short of mass vaccination and therapies, to be able to blunt the epidemic. And in fact, in the SARS situation, which is probably not feasible now, but it's a possibility, we use that approach to literally eliminate SARS. You know, there has been since 2003 no recurrence of that SARS virus. That would be actually the hope. We're actually seeing that, as I mentioned to you before, when we look at what we look at is the number of new cases per day. And you may have heard this number, but that in the United States in the last few days, the doubling of the new cases occurs every 3 days. That's horrendous, right? And what we're trying to do is actually flattening that curve. In other words, soon it will be once every 2 days, and once every day, the doubling, simply because of the mathematics. But if we can flatten that out, that means that our social interventions are working. And every indication, whenever these the social distancing policies are put in place, those new cases are not going away, unfortunately, but they are clearly flattening out. And there are other very interesting pieces of data that we can talk about at another time that suggest that fewer people are getting infected throughout the United States because of these policies.
Mark, thanks for your question. And a note here that Governor Janet Mills will hold a press briefing this afternoon to announce major new actions to protect the health and safety of Maine people in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. The event's scheduled for 4:30 in the afternoon and will be carried live on Maine Public Television, Maine Public Radio, at mainepublic.org, and on the Maine Public Facebook page. We're talking with Dr. Ed Liu, President and CEO of the Jackson Lab. We'll be right back after a short break.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Freeman Ellis Family Fund, supporting Maine Public Radio, local, national, and international news you can trust. The Maine Center for Disease Control holds a daily weekday update and briefing on the coronavirus for the citizens of Maine. You can watch it in its entirety on Maine Public Television, on our website, mainepublic.org, and on the Maine Public Facebook page. We'll let you know here what time the briefing is scheduled for when we know. Again, the daily briefing on the coronavirus from the Maine CDC can be seen on Maine Public Television, on our website, mainepublic.org, and on the Maine Public Facebook page. They will also be archived each day for later viewing. Please visit mainepublic.org and click on the television drop-down. Trusted news, quality entertainment, and lifelong learning is what Maine Public Television is all about, four channels strong. We've made some adjustments to provide more daytime educational fare, from science to history programming for the older kids who find themselves home during this time of social distancing. We have the PBS Kids channel for preschool kids, but our main channel just added more afternoon programming for older learners, starting now at 1:30 each afternoon. And the Maine Public World channel is now doing the same each weekday afternoon from 12 to 5. Television programming that is worthwhile and educational to watch. See the schedule for our Maine HD and World channels at mainepublic.org. Click on the television drop-down.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and today we are talking about ways to slow the COVID-19 pandemic and what people need to know about reducing the spread of virus. Joining me, Dr. Ed Liu with the Jackson Lab. Join our conversation if you'd like at 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to Bob on Facebook. He writes, I have not been out for about 14 days, so have not been near another person, nor have I touched a surface other than in my home. Can I assume I am virus-free?
If you're not, I don't know how to become virus-free. That's pretty admirable how you're able to keep yourself in that state. But in truth, if you don't have symptoms, it's highly unlikely that you have the COVID-19. Being separated this far, usually the course of the COVID-19 is already in a two-week period. And if you haven't had any symptoms, it's highly, highly, highly unlikely that you have anything.
An email from PG. How long does it take after being exposed yourself before you are exposing others to COVID-19?
Oh, geez, that's a really good question. And again, we have only estimates. First of all, you have to be infected and it has to take up. Not everybody who is in contact with somebody will actually get the virus. But assuming that you do, the incubation period is said to be between 4 and 7 days. So there's a period of time between 4 and 7 days where you may not exhibit symptoms. Now, unlike some other diseases, COVID-19 has been shown that some individuals will excrete that virus before they have symptoms. How soon afterwards, it's really not clear. But once a person has symptoms, then it is highly likely that they will be shedding, as we call it, shedding the virus.
All right. Jane on Facebook says, if cases of COVID-19 diminish greatly over the summer, what would cause it to flare up again in the fall?
Very good question, Jane. First of all, this happened in the 1918 pandemic. What happens is that all the efforts caused the frequency of the infection to go way, way, way down. But then what happens is then usually because these social distancing policies are relaxed relatively early, and then people start going out and then reinfecting, not reinfecting people who've already been infected, but infecting people who have protected themselves while they're at home. And there may be a second wave. So these second wave events actually do occur. There are two issues here. How long can we keep the social distancing going without really hurting our economy? The second is if we have enough tests, then we could be much more surgical in terms of the isolation. And then the third, assuming that there may be a drug that is out there, those things, not any one of them will solve the problem, but they will certainly blunt the impact of that second wave.
All righty. We're going to go to Maura, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Maura. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, thank you, Dr. Wu, and your organization for your work. So my question is, since this is a respiratory infection and a lot of it is airborne, can people do something at home, like even something as simple as gargling with hot salted water and doing a neti pot nasal wash with saline to help reduce the virus that's incoming? I read somewhere that the virus stays in the throat for about 24 hours, and this gives a little lag time for the body to develop antibodies. I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Those are very, very good questions, and unfortunately, I have no answers for you because it's never been tested before. So, but I would say gargling and neti pots aren't dangerous, and many people use them, so I don't see the harm. But I can't give you really a definitive scientific answer.
We'll go to Jeff, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead with your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I had two questions, but one of them's been answered. Thank you, Dr. Liu. The other one is a tag-along to a question that Jennifer asked earlier, and that has to do with someone who has the disease and recovers from it, then now we assume to be immune from it. But that, so does their immunity prevent them from being able to pass it on again if they are exposed to somebody else who has the disease in the future?
The answer is, Jeff, absolutely yes. And this is why. If you're really immune to the COVID-19, that COVID-19 is never going to take hold in your body. And if it doesn't take hold in your body, it won't reproduce and it won't be expelled or shed. So in that framework, you should be pretty clear and free.
Jeff, thanks for your question. We will go to Jim, who's calling from Spruce Head. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call and appreciate the good information. Just quickly, if I'm walking down, say, an aisle in the grocery store and someone sneezed a few minutes before, is there a cloud there? And how long does that stay up in the air, those droplets? How long do they stay up in the air before they fall to the floor or the ground?
Okay. You know, these estimates are all estimates done on in certain studies in a very isolated experimental conditions in a cloud chamber, more or less a cloud chamber. So you have to be careful about generalizations. Okay. As I mentioned before, a sneeze cloud can persist, not will persist, but can persist for up to 3 hours. There is a half-life. In other words, it falls off by one half in the first hour, so it goes farther and farther down. It also depends on airflow. And so many characteristics that are there. So I hope that gives you a little bit of some guidelines, but none of these numbers are etched in stone.
Okay, Jim in Spruce Head, thanks for your question. And following up, Dr. Liu, if someplace has good airflow, you can, for example, feel the breeze as you are walking under a vent or something like that, does that mean that virus is probably not existing in a cloud under that vent?
Gosh, you know, again, there's so many conditions. I would be loath to tell you that you're safe. Okay, I really do. It's been tried in hospital conditions in China, where they used special equipment to suck in air and then test whether COVID-19 exists. And under certain circumstances, they do exist. But this is in an area where many sick people are in an enclosed area, even if they have air handling. One thing that I do think is relatively secure is that if you're outside and there is a breeze, it's highly, highly unlikely, and you're not around people, it's highly, highly unlikely that you're going to be in contact with the virus.
All right. And anything about temperature? Do we know, does it survive better or worse, say, in some place it's cold or some place that's warm?
Well, again, for the coronaviruses in experimental situation, warm and humid areas don't do well for the virus. But then again, think about it. You know, the SARS virus occurred in Guangdong, China, which is southern China, and Singapore. So just because they don't like that kind of weather, doesn't mean that they can't survive well, especially in high numbers.
I'll go to Ted, who's calling from Belfast. Ted, if you could ask your question quickly, that would be great.
Great. My question is about fresh meat and fish. Some stores aren't carrying it. Why is this? If the staff took precautions like wearing gloves and masks when they're putting out food, wouldn't that cover it? Because the staff that stock the grocery stores are touching everything else anyway. I'm wondering, what is the issue? Is this, can it be transmitted through fresh meats and fish?
Well, we have not had any reports of being transmitted in this manner, in this oral manner. Okay, so I can't say it won't happen, but we haven't had any indication that it does. But the second issue here is exposed surfaces are always subject to, falling droplets. That's why by the covering of the meats that you see in grocery stores like Hannaford's is to minimize that kind of exposure during the course of a day in the grocery store. I think that it's perfectly reasonable. Does it really work? Will it really help? I really can't say.
Ted, thanks for your question. And I have a related question from Jessica on Facebook. She says, should we be disinfecting or quarantining all of our groceries before we bring them into the house?
I know that there are online a lot of people considering this. The problem is there isn't a truly correct set of behaviors, except caution and cleanliness. I can only tell you what I do. I go to the grocery store, I pick up the foods, I make sure when I come home, I put those things out, I wash them carefully, and then I wash my hands. That's what I do. It doesn't mean that I have the lock on the truth on how to handle food? No. But I think for me, that is sufficient.
When you say you wash things, obviously fruits and vegetables, do you take, for example, to a box of cereal, disinfecting wipe or something like that?
I personally don't, but again, it's really your risk tolerance. I think you're much more likely to get COVID-19 by being in proximity with a sick person than you would, quite frankly, by picking up things in a grocery store. But, you know, it's all a probability issue, and it depends on your risk tolerance.
Well, Dr. Edison Liu, thank you so much for spending time with us today on Maine Calling. Ed Liu is president and CEO of the Jackson Laboratory.
Thank you so very much.
Yeah, and you can see him at 7 o'clock tonight if you have more questions for him. On tomorrow's program, in the first hour, we are going to address the many personal finance concerns that people have during this global pandemic. In our second hour, we're going to speak with the newspaper editors from around the state about top issues affecting Maine this past month. And a news update. Today at 4:30, Governor Janet Mills will hold a news conference to announce major new actions to protect the health and safety of Maine people in the face of COVID-19. Maine Public Radio and Television will cover the press conference live. You can find it at mainepublic.org and on the Maine Public Facebook page. Sandra Harris ran the board today. This program will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.